to ask Governor Scott and other elected leaders to begin the process here in Florida. We need to close these loopholes. We need to make sure that you can't buy a gun at a gun show without having a background check, and that you can't buy a gun from a personal individual without having a background check. And so it has to begin at the state level, because unfortunately at the federal level, the NRA and the gun lobby have a lock there. And we saw in Florida in the last legislative session two bills, one that would have allowed guns on campus, even though every state university president, every college president was opposed to it. The NRA supported it. And so we had to work feverishly to defeat that. We also had a bill that proposed open carry, where anyone could, in public view, walk around with a gun, and therefore you don't know who is the person with ill intent and the person with good intent. And we were able to defeat that.
We just have 5 seconds, and I wanted to go back to Rebecca Peters. In that 5 seconds, what you think is the most important way that you got this kind of legislation passed?
Definitely bipartisan agreement was the key, because—
And when you don't have that?
And when you don't, well, taking on board the opinions of the experts, the public health community, the crime prevention community—
We have to leave it there. I want to thank you both for being with us. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 8:01. Coming up next is more talk radio with hosts Celeste Carey and Cecil Prescott. Today's guest is campaign director for Jubilee USA, Andrew Hanauer, who will talk about combating global poverty.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 2016 Juneteenth Oregon Celebration. It will end at the Juneteenth Oregon Celebration at Legacy Emanuel Field at Northeast Graham in Vancouver at noon. The celebration will be from noon to 7 p.m. and feature family fun and activities, community vendors, music and other live entertainment, and much, much more. Again, that's the 2016 Juneteenth Oregon Celebration, Saturday, June 18th, with the parade from 10:45 to noon and a celebration from noon to 7 p.m. at Legacy Emanuel Field at Northeast Graham in Vancouver and Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Debtors Assembly in St. John's, Tuesday, June 21st at 4 p.m. under the bridge at Cathedral Park in Portland. Strike Debt is a nationwide movement of debt resistors fighting for economic justice and democratic freedom. This event also features a Strike Debt Portland potluck. Again, that's the Debtors Assembly in St. John's, Tuesday, June 21st, 4 to 7 p.m. at Cathedral Park in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Listening to
KBOO Portland, your community radio station. And this is More Talk Radio. My name is Cecil Prescott, and I'll be joined by my co-host Celeste Carey. Today is Monday, June 13th, 2016. And let me give you places where you can actually listen to us. So if you are in Portland, it's 90.7. If you are in Hood River, it's 91.9. And if you are in Corvallis, Albany area, it's 104.3. You're listening on Monday, June 13th. Certainly you are aware of the massacre at the club in Orlando. And there is nothing I can say. It's just important for people to continue to create spaces where they can affirm and celebrate themselves and be aware of the struggle that continues in places in your communities and in communities throughout the world. The struggle for justice continues as we continue to mourn those who suffer and die because of who they are. Strangely enough, maybe not so strangely, I'm at a loss for word. But as the struggle for justice continues, and you will hear more about this on this radio station, we want to expand our conversation by talking about an issue that certainly impacts all of us. Joining us today is Andrew Hanauer, who is the campaigns director of Jubilee USA. Andrew will be in Portland this evening to give a presentation and discussion about his work. It will be at the Holiday Park Plaza on Northeast 16th, 1300 Northeast 16th Avenue from 5:30 to 8 p.m., talking about the work of Jubilee USA. But we have an opportunity to preview his discussion presentation this evening. And Andrew is joining us on the phone. Good morning, Andrew.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me on.
Well, thank you for joining us. And you're in Seattle right now?
That's right, yes. I'm in Seattle.
Okay, so we'll see you this evening in Portland. Perhaps we can begin for you just sharing a little bit of information for our listeners who are unfamiliar with the work of Jubilee, and tell us about Jubilee USA Network.
Sure. So Jubilee USA is a coalition of about 75 national organizations, a pretty big range and broad range of groups. And we also represent about 550 churches, synagogues, mosques, faith communities of different types around the country. We work on what we believe are the root causes of poverty, so structural issues, systemic issues, everything from tax avoidance to debt to trade policy to corruption and transparency issues. And I think, you know, those issues, when you put them together, they can start to address why we have a billion people in our world living in poverty. So our work is aimed at changing that leave people in poverty by influencing, the actions of policymakers from the White House to the IMF to the United Nations.
And certainly your work is broad, as you suggested, in terms of not only the numbers of people involved in the coalition, but to address the root causes of poverty may seem overwhelming and impossible to solve. But one
thing that I think people can appreciate is the work of Jubilee, and in terms of taking on these important issues, your ability to bring people together, bring organizations together, and certainly have a real impact on people's life throughout the world. Most recently, and I think people might be aware of, is the debt crisis in Puerto Rico, and the recent House vote. I think it was last week. Is that correct? The House voted.
Yes, it was last Thursday.
Again, I'm going to ask you to give a little generalization about the history of the debt crisis. People might be aware or might have heard something about the debt crisis in Puerto Rico. And perhaps, why is it important? Tell us a little bit about the history of that crisis.
Sure. And I appreciate your kind comments about our organization as well. And I would say, we got our start working on the fact that the poorest countries in the world were billions of dollars in debt, and yet didn't have enough money to pay for basic health and education services for their people. And so, our campaigns for debt relief have won about $130 billion in debt relief. And when we started, people laughed. They said, no one's going to ever cancel these debts. That's just not going to happen. But it did happen, and it happened because of our work bringing together, a huge range of people who don't ever even necessarily agree with each other on other issues, but who came together for this and got that debt canceled. And because that debt was canceled, more kids are going back to school. The World Bank says fewer kids are dying of preventable diseases in poor countries. So it really had a tremendous impact. Now, however, as you mentioned, the debt crisis has really hit home, because right now 3.5 million American citizens living in Puerto Rico owe $72 billion in debt. So that's $20,000 per person. Almost 60% of Puerto Rico's kids live in poverty, and about 45% overall live in poverty. And the thing about Puerto Rico is that, all you have to do if you want to leave Puerto Rico is pay about $150 for a plane ticket to Florida. And so as the crisis has gotten worse, people who live in Puerto Rico who have some means have left, and that means that they have even less money to collect in taxes. And so it's just a downward spiral where jobs are leaving and money is leaving and things just get really bad. The origins of the crisis are many. There's been a fair amount of corruption and mismanagement, but I think also there's been very unequal treatment for Puerto Rico under U.S. law. I think on top of that, the financial crisis hit Puerto Rico really, really hard. I think right now the question is what do we do about it? And that's where our organization is really working hard to address the crisis.
And the vote that was taken in the House last week, it took a lot of work on a lot of people and trying to build a coalitions. And as someone who works in Washington, you know how difficult it is to get Democrats and Republicans to agree. But even in the midst of that struggle to get some agreement on how to address the debt issues, there seems to have been, one thing, a push by your organization to really address and other organization to address childhood poverty there, but also a tension on what I would think normally people you might assume are allies who question on.
And for the listeners, I think the bottom line is that the bill allows Puerto Rico to restructure its debt, all of its debt. It basically, like you would in a bankruptcy, except that Puerto Rico doesn't have access to bankruptcy. This is necessary. If Puerto Rico can't restructure its debt, it can't pay its debt. And if it can't pay its debt, it's going to continue to spiral downwards. I think that what the bill also does is creates an oversight board, which I think causes a lot of people concern, including us. Mm-hmm. The oversight board allows Congress to create this board that will have some rights to, approve or question Puerto Rico's budget decisions for a fixed temporary period of time. But the reality is the Supreme Court of the U.S. ruled that Puerto Rico is not able to restructure its own debt. So, in other words, Washington has to act. This bill was complicated. It was politically difficult. There was millions of dollars in special interest lobbying, special interest ads aimed at trying to kill this bill because wealthy interests wanted the bill dead. So we worked really hard to build a real bipartisan consensus around this bill and to get it passed. Ultimately, 87% of House Republicans voted for it in Washington today, especially given how, as you mentioned, the two parties don't work very well together, frankly.
So can you explain why... What is to be gained by these special interests that do not want Puerto Rico to have the debt restructured and to be able to survive? I mean, I'm understanding that there is a strong reluctance on the part of some parties for Puerto Rico to even consider anything remotely like sovereignty. But to have the debt restructured and at least survive makes sense, but these parties would gain from not having this debt restructured.
That's a great question. What they want is a bailout. What they want is for Puerto Rico to be bailed out, because really what that would mean is the creditors are bailed out. So if you made bad loans and you know they're bad, you know they were risky, and now they've proven too risky, and rather than accept responsibility for that, they would prefer that Puerto Rico be given a cash infusion, which then would be basically directly transferred to them to pay off their debt.
Much like we did with our banks then.
Correct.
So in other words, if I'm hearing you correctly, what we have is second and third world nations that perhaps with a little assistance and nothing more than simple debt restructuring could be able to survive, but when you factor in the fact that they need debt restructuring just because you've got greedy organizations and banks that, I mean, basically make all the money they can and then still get paid once they're bailed out, that's one of the reasons we're looking at this world debt crisis overall.
I think that we need responsibility among all parties, and I think when we talk about responsibility, I think pretty often it's only used to talk about the person who borrows the money.
Right, instead of the lender.
Exactly. I think we need to look at both sides. Both sides need to be responsible. Puerto Rico's government is responsible for its mismanagement and corruption. Mm-hmm. But the folks who loan the money are responsible as well. And so I think restructuring needs to be done fairly and treat all parties fairly. I think most of the creditors, I think, are there. I think they get that and they understand it. But there are some who would rather fight to try to force Congress to do what they want. But they're losing, and that's the tremendous thing. We organized 2,000 phone calls to Congress to make the debt time that these groups were spending millions of dollars to try to get them to make the debt provisions worse or just defeat the bill. So against $2 million and our 2,000 phone calls and our efforts on Capitol Hill, where we were bringing the Archbishop of San Juan and faith leaders from all over the United States, we won. The debt provisions got better, and then the bill passed. And then every amendment designed to kill it was beaten. So
that's an incredible irony that they spent this much money to get money that was not good money.
Yep, that's true. That is true.
And also, I think that one campaign, I think, shows the ability to confront the powers that be by organizing in what may seem an impossible situation.
Yeah.
And it reminds me of, something you touch upon earlier in our conversation about the challenge of a world debt relief and how enormous of a task it is. And when people began thinking about that possibility, it seems impossible. What do you think are some of the forces that enable Jubilee with its partners to actually take on the principalities and powers and to address debt relief and to be successful in many cases?
Yeah, I appreciate the question. You know, I think a huge part of our success has been who we represent and how we represent ourselves. We have used an inclusive voice since our founding. And what I mean by that is you don't have to sacrifice your principles, but you also don't have to alienate potential allies by the words that you use. And so, you know, for instance, we work on the issue of corporations not paying their taxes. It's a huge problem. We're losing billions of dollars because corporations aren't paying their taxes. But we don't talk about it in the sense of these evil corporations are, you know, are ruining everyone's lives. Because when you talk like that, I think it can and often alienate some of the people you need to win to your side. So what we talk about is the fact that when corporations don't pay their taxes, it really has an impact on very vulnerable people who rely on the resources that those taxes fund. And so the same was true of debt relief. We were able to get everyone from Jesse Jackson to Pat Robertson. On a humanitarian level, it was immoral for these countries to be paying off the debts of their former dictators when their people were starving to death. I mean, the president of Tanzania, Julius Nyerere, said, you know, must we starve our children to pay our debts? And I think that question allowed us to bring together people who often disagree, and in fact our largest debt relief victory in Congress was signed by President Bush. So I think that's a big part of it. And I think the other part of it is, you know, in Washington, I think the fact that we represent, you know, large religious institutions and go into meetings with members of the clergy, I think significantly helps us in our ability to work with the members of both parties. And we have a lot of secular partners as well. We're not simply religious partners, but we, I think we're very proud of our work with our religious partners to win these sorts of changes.
You are listening to More Talk Radio here on your community connection, KBOO Portland, 90.7 here in the metro area, 104 Point South in Philomath, and in Hood River, Oregon, it is 91.9 here. And we are speaking today with, last name's Gallagher?
Hanauer.
How did I get Gallagher? I'm having one of those moments Monday. And you represent Jubilee?
USA.
USA. Two things I think would be really interesting to hear are some of your secular partners, and maybe if you have business partners that might be kind of surprising that you are surprised that come to the table.
Sure. So on a national, I mean, we have thousands of people around the country of all personal, spiritual, you know, perspectives. And so
right.
In that sense, they are our secular partners as well. We have on our national board and steering committee, we have groups like Friends of the Earth, Oxfam America, the AFL-CIO, and ActionAid USA. So there's a pretty broad range, and there's others as well. In terms of business partners, you know, one of the things that we have found is that there's a small group of hedge funds that are commonly called vulture funds because they have a very exploitative business model based on buying up debt from entities that are in economic distress, so countries that are in economic distress, and then waiting for the right moment and suing them for everything they've got. And what we found in our work to try to stop these funds is that a lot of the financial institutions in New York and elsewhere don't like them either. So we have had some relationships with business interests and groups like that who say, yeah, we don't think this is the right business model and actually hurts New York as a financial center because it causes folks to not want to sign contracts in New York out of fear that they'll be exploited by vulture funds. So I would say that's probably been the one intersection there with the business community.
Well, that's kind of encouraging that even though it's still kind of focused on their bottom line, there is a recognition of that interconnectedness.
Sure. Absolutely.
I'd like to, at this time, just open our conversation to people who are all listening, who have questions for Andrews. Our numbers are 503-231-8187. Give him a call if you have a question or comment. In recent months, we've been made aware of the so-called Panama Papers. And I think it's important for your work, Andrew, to share with us what does it reveals about financial institutions in terms of how they may continue to help create the problems that is harmful. And what did you discover? I'm sure, you know, your nighttime reading, you just opening up all those pages of documents in terms of either confirming your work that you do.
Yeah, the Panama Papers was incredible. And, you know, for anyone who's not aware, this was the largest leak in world history in terms of the amount of data. And what it exposed was how the wealthy and the powerful, but also the criminals, use the financial system to hide money and to launder money. So, you know, the Panama Papers involved case studies involving 200,000 what we call shell companies. So these are companies that are created just on paper. They don't do any actual business. And all they are vehicles to move money. And unfortunately, it's very easy to set up these shell companies anonymously so that nobody, including law enforcement, can track what you're doing. This about the Panama Papers was that, you know, in the U.S. media, I think, was that this was a Panama issue, an offshore issue, a issue for, you know, secretive people doing secretive things in other countries, because there were very few Americans mentioned in the Panama Papers. But here's the reality. The reason there's so few Americans mentioned in the Panama Papers is because if you're an American and you want to set up a fake shell company to launder money, you don't have to go to Panama. You can do it right here. In fact, this is the easiest country in the world to set up an anonymous shell company. In fact, Oregon is one of the worst states at allowing people to set up anonymous shell companies. It's actually, you know, really a hub for this activity. So to give you a really good example of that, there was a company in the Ukraine that swindled its own government out of money by overcharging it for vaccines. Now, keep in mind the human cost of this. This was during a time when the Ukraine was fighting a polio epidemic for children. And so this company was overcharging its government for these vaccines, meaning fewer kids got vaccinated. To make this happen, this company set up a fake shell company to launder its money through. But it didn't set that company up in Ukraine. It didn't set it up in Russia. It didn't set it up in Europe. It set it up in Oregon.
Oh, that's ugly.
So this is the reality that the Panama Papers exposes, that our financial system here in the United States is really complicit in allowing very, very bad crimes and corruption around the world, human trafficking, terrorism, drug running. And so there's a bill right now in Congress to address that, and that's a big focus of our work and something that I look forward to talking about more when I'm in Portland tonight.
You're listening to More Talk Radio. Join the conversation. The phone number is 503-231-8187. So I have a question here. Given the way we are fighting a rather convoluted battle with oil and over oil right now, and how most, I'm sure, of the world is happy that oil is cheap, except for all the businesses that want oil to be artificially inflated. And then the fact that you've got attacks on ISIS oil refineries by some of our larger economies in the world. How does this volatility of oil play into global debt, or does it?
Well, it certainly causes problems for oil-producing countries. So right now, there's a debt crisis in Venezuela that's only just getting started.
And Saudi Arabia as well.
And so, yeah, and but I mean, I think for the really the poorest,
well, the really poorest countries. Uh-huh.
Yeah, I think Venezuela, Nigeria, other countries in that situation, it could cause a huge problem. I think what this is getting at, and I think what's really important is the idea that we have to have economies that go beyond the swing of commodity prices. We have to have a financial system where if a commodity goes up or down, the entire economy doesn't collapse. And this has really, really, really severe consequences. So, you know, many people know and have heard of the Rwandan genocide and understand that it was a conflict between one ethnic group and another. But the reality that a lot of people don't know is that right before that conflict broke out, the price of coffee had plummeted, which had basically wrecked Rwanda's economy. And at the same time, the country had undergone a structural adjustment program with the International Monetary Fund that, in many people's views, made the situation worse. And so actually during the genocide, there was reports that in some communities where the minority ethnic group, the Tutsis, were not present, and so there were none of them to kill, the poorer Hutus killed richer Hutus because the chaos was such that they could get away with it and because they were in such desperate economic straits that they wanted to get out of that. And so really the economy fueled that conflict. It wasn't just about ethnic strife. And if we have economies that are based only on the price of coffee or the price of oil, that's going to continue to happen.
So I remember watching a movie and it got the opportunity to interview the director. The movie was The End of Poverty? And one of the things it discussed is how a quartet of European powers are the cause, very deliberate cause, of the crash of many economies of lesser second and third world countries by focusing their economies maybe on a single product or a commodity or a resource. Is part of what you see as your vision for Jubilee USA and the other Jubilees worldwide a way, the whole idea of a single commodity or single item economy, and maybe bringing some countries back to their more traditional economies so that they are not so dependent upon the marky whimsy like we just discussed with the crash of oil producing countries that need the money, but oil using countries.
Our goal at Jubilee USA, and as you mentioned, there are Jubilees in about 50 countries around the world that are partners of ours. We're not one umbrella organization, but we're partners. Our job at Jubilee USA is to make sure that our government here in the United States is enacting policies that promote healthy, sustainable economies around the world and reduce poverty. Ultimately, you know, a country in Africa or Latin America or Asia will need to make its own decisions about what kind of economy it wants to pursue.
Mm-hmm.
But we should make sure that the rules of the global economy don't push countries into situations where they are forced to make decisions that are ultimately harmful. So I think there's no question that in countries where they've become basically a one commodity exporting country, there's a lot of risk for financial crisis. And other problems, but I think, you know, our view is that our job is to try to number one, change the rules, and number two, make sure that systems are in place so that when, you know, if the country is in that situation and the inevitable collapse happens, that financial crisis is mitigated and made as less devastating as possible.
You're listening to More Talk Radio here on KBOO. Portland, your community radio station. My name is Cecil Charles Prescott.
I am Celeste Carey. And where are you?
Where are you? Give us a call, 503-231-8187. We're speaking with Andrew Hanauer, Campaigns Director of Jubilee USA. Andrew will be in Portland this evening speaking at an event at the Holiday Park Plaza, 1300 Northeast 16th Avenue at 5:30 p.m. Andrew, I'm wondering in terms of moving countries, moving governments, moving institutions to agree to the principles of debt relief, and it's more of a question of how in terms of looking at countries with enormous debt, what is it do we do to convince institutions to move in favor of debt relief? One common response I've often heard is sort of like, well, you know, they made that debt, they have to pay it. What motivates institutions and peoples to move in the direction of debt relief?
Yeah, it's a good question, and I think, you know, with the original wave of the Jubilee movement in the late 90s, there were really two elements to it. There was a recognition that number one, this was a humanitarian crisis, that these countries were so in debt that they weren't able to even fund basic services for their people. And so that was the principal driver. I think the second driver was the fact that in the 90s, a lot of the dictators who had racked up this debt had left. They had been either, put into exile or killed or defeated when the country finally allowed elections. And so you had this unique historical situation where all these countries that had been under authoritarian rule suddenly were free, and yet saddled with the debts of their former dictators. And I think the most glaring example of that was apartheid South Africa, mm-hmm. where you had Nelson Mandela's government forced to pay off debts made to the apartheid regime, in often cases used by the apartheid regime to fund its security services or other means of repression. So this was a very stark moral situation, both in terms of humanitarian concerns and in terms of justice concerns. I think that beyond that campaign, we have continued to win debt relief. But I think ultimately what we need is not specifically debt relief, but rather a larger model for how to organize the economy. And so our work is centered on that idea that you have to, yes, cancel debt where necessary, but also stop countries from going into debt in the first place by making sure that money is loaned responsibly, by making sure that we can get rid of corruption by not, you know, first of all, not enabling it with our own financial system and Oregon's own financial system, by making the rules of the financial system more transparent, and by making sure that corporations are paying their taxes so that countries have the revenue they need so they don't have to take out new loans. So all those things put together are, you know, in a sense, what we call Jubilee. It's a concept of an economy that's built on right relationships instead of broken relationships. And that's ultimately what we're aiming at creating.
Thank you. We're speaking with Andrew Hanauer of Jubilee USA. Let's go to our caller. LJ, good morning.
Good morning. LJ, you're on. Hello?
Hello?
Yes, you're on.
Yay, hooray. Oh, well, hi, Mr. Andrew. How are you today?
Good, sir. How are you?
Good, good. Can we talk about student loan debt here
Absolutely.
In the U.S.?
Absolutely.
It's my understanding that address the fact that the federal the debt weighs heavily on Afro-Americans and Latinos.
Yes.
And the federal government will make $66 billion. Off student loan debt, and can you address what can possibly be done about that? Because these students, as far as I can see, are simply indentured servants now. And how is the best way to address this problem? Should the federal government forgive every civilized country in the world? Treats their youth as an asset, and they're educated for free. And thank you very much. I certainly will take my answer off the air. Have
thank
a good day.
You. Thank you for your question, LJ.
Thank you.
Thanks, LJ.
Ah.
It's It's definitely an enormous concern. And one of the interesting things is when I travel and speak, and as I'm doing tonight in Portland, you know, sometimes it's difficult for some folks to sort of country like Sierra Leone or to really focus on that as an important issue to them personally. But here's the reality: almost everyone we know knows somebody with student loan debt, and a lot of the dynamics are very similar. I think one of the things that we've been focused on, the fact that predatory is very much in force around student debt, just as it is around a country's debt. And so we had last year the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau fining a company that had been calling students at 2 in the morning, harassing them, telling them they had to pay more than they actually had to pay. And that sort of protection is desperately needed. We need to protect our students from predatory collection actions. You're absolutely right that student debt is disproportionately impacting young people of color. That is true, as is actions of that we have begun to work on significantly. Right now in the United States, the average person taking out a payday loan is paying interest rates annually of something like 390%.
Oh my goodness.
It's
but that doesn't that fall under the terms of usury, and isn't that generally against the law?
It's certainly usury, something like, I think I want to say 20 states, I could be wrong about that number, have passed laws to prevent that. But yet, just last week, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau issued new regulations, really modest, simple regulations, that probably didn't go far enough.
Mm-hmm.
Basically saying that if you're going to loan money to someone and charge high interest rates, you have to make sure not only can they pay it back, but they can also fund basic services for their family. In other words, they can put food on the table. They can pay their rent.
And I thought that was a basic premise anyway of garnishing and what have you, that there had to be a living wage left out of that that is supposed to be proportionate to your ability to survive and continue to make money to pay that possibly illegal or at least immoral debt.
That's right, and that's the premise, and that's something that payday lending needs to include. But even that was, you know, a bipartisan bill in Congress intended to block them and then delay them for 2 years. The payday lending industry is enormously influential with both parties. I think in terms of student debt, we really need to look at how it's been accrued, what our system is overall. I don't know that, you know, every single student debt should be just wiped out, but I think that we need to have, absolutely need to have some sort of system in place to get these students, you know, back up on their feet, give them opportunities, get them out of debt, and prevent the next wave of students from going into debt in the first place. I think that's really, really important, and it needs to reflect exactly the kinds of things we're working on internationally.
Well, thank you, and we'll go to our next caller. Good morning, George. You're on the air.
Good morning, Celeste, and I want to thank you for having this very important question of poverty. It's so essential that we address this, and I'm wondering if your guest and you would agree or disagree that apart from the relations of the economy with its victims and or with its citizens and the relations among the politicians, that there is a more powerful force operating, which is that the giant firms and extremely wealthy individuals have managed to follow an economy which puts profit or profits on money invested first in general, before Mother Earth, before social justice, before elite gets a large part or all of the profits it wants, but is willing to make concessions to help noble causes to get rid of poverty. But if this primary motive exists, I'm wondering, would you say, is it going to be ever possible under the system called capital to get out from under these problems? And now I'll just leave this to hear what you folks say.
That's a great question. You nailed it.
Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks, George.
And Andrew?
Sure. I think in any situation, there always has to be two tracks. There has to be efforts to change a system when it's necessary, and there has to be efforts to improve a system within. I think that philanthropy is good. People who have money should certainly donate it as they see fit to causes that are noble. But philanthropy is not going to change the system. And so we need to address the structures and policies and systems that cause a situation we have right now where 62 people have the same amount of wealth as the poorest 3.5 billion people. And that's an insane statistic. Caller, I don't think that that the current system is working. I think we need to change it. I'm not speaking of doing away with capitalism, but rather with really transforming the systems that we set up in our global economy. And I think that alone will have a tremendous impact. And I think maybe the capitalism debate is left for others.
You know, and it's unfortunate that we're a little short of time and now we've got a lot of callers, because I would love to hear what the world conglomerate of Jubilee organizations would view as a viable world economy, what system they would like to work under, because I think we would have our eyes opened a lot. But I'll save that question for another time. We'll go to our next caller.
Yes, thank you. I've only been in your call here for about 15 minutes, and it's very interesting call. And I'm part of an organization that now has, as effective last week, the people in Italy take part in a new strategy of free energy, and it's been arranged through the banking in Italy with about 6,000 locations. These people can go in and apply for a credit loan and purchase a unit through the bank, through the keshfoundation.org. And the Kesh Foundation sends them out these plasma field energy units. They plug them into their homes, and it begins to coat their homes with nanoparticles on their copper wiring and receive energy from the plastic field rather than from the energy grid. And through the course of this, their utility bills go down. And it's been set up with the banks. They'll be paying something like about 22 euros a month for the next 3 years to do this, and they're able to pay that out of the regard. And they're also participating in different ways to get this energy out there. Mr. Kesh started decades ago, and more recently here in the last 2 years, he created a thing called Free Energy for World Peace. And he's offering free teachings on the internet through livestream.com, or you can pick up the link on keshfoundation.org. And I've had it's an amazing thing, because these issues that you're talking about today are all dressed about creating a new banking system for the planet, getting rid of the global banking elite. It's creating marvelous things in the health field, with people reducing cancers and all other kinds of conditions. It's taken off with agriculture, where there are phenomenal yields that are coming to people in different areas around the planet by using this technology. I'm just trying to find a way to get this message out there to the people. And I've been cut off after about a minute and a half. So it's nice to talk to KBOO for at least 2 minutes here.
Okay, and could you tell us again that the link to the site?
Kesh, K-E-S-H-E, like in she, it's Kesh, K-E-S-H-E, foundation.org.
Okay.
And you'll see a couple buttons on there. One will go to livestream.com, and the other goes to YouTube. And the livestream.com, if you catch the broadcast when it is at our time and on a Tuesday morning, and the other 6 a.m. on Thursdays, and you can ask questions, get your questions answered there. But on livestream, it's a 24/7 replay.
Okay.
And I would a good place to start on that is if you go to the live stream and you go to the 106th Knowledge Seekers Workshop.
Okay, we'll reference that, but we want to let our other caller get in. And thank you so much for the call and the information.
Mm-hmm. All righty.
All right. And I want to throw a question out there. I don't know if we're going to have time because we've got a crunch here. Because Oregon is a state that is basically guilty worldwide of pandering to and allowing this disproportionate debt worldwide, this global debt crisis, what can people who live here do to change that outlet? That outlook and to close that loop?
That's a great question. So right now there's a bill in the House and the Senate. In the House, it's called H.R. 4450. In the Senate, it's Senate Bill 2489. So that's H.R. 4450, Senate Bill 2489. And it would make it that when you not be public, but it would be accessible by law enforcement. So my sense is generally Senator Wyden is supportive of that initiative, and I imagine Senator Merkley would be as well. But they should hear from you. As should your members of the House of Representatives. This is a bipartisan bill in both the House and the Senate, but it's facing significant opposition. So all your phone calls and emails can help. And there's information on our website about this as well, jubileeusa.org. And also come hear me talk tonight at 5:30, and you can connect with Jubilee Oregon, which is a great group of local churches and individuals of any faith or no faith who are working together on these issues.
It would be helpful, it seems, also if while you're visiting Oregon, to convince Jubilee Oregon to really connect with the unions, because I could see how unions could not only benefit for this, but offer some really canny and insightful support.
Absolutely.
All right, well, we'll see if we can get this last caller.
Yeah, I got a question. When you talk about this impacts minorities, we have to look at the military. The military is primarily made up of poor people and minorities. But that is an avenue where they can get a free education, free college. So I'm not quite understanding when you're saying loans impact minorities. That don't start a jive, man, with what's going on with the military. Also, I believe that everybody should go into the Peace Corps. There are ways to get an education without taking a loan. You got to also look at immigrants that come over here, get a free education, and then they go back to their countries. They don't pay the debt. It's left here for us Americans to pay for it. So I wish you would address that too. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Michael. I might disagree in terms of how immigrants pay for their education, but we'll let Andrew respond.
Sure. And Michael, thanks for the call. And I think it's a great point that there are avenues within the United States where folks can get an education for free. In terms of student debt disproportionately impacting minorities, I don't have the statistic at my fingertips, but my understanding is that just statistically, African Americans are more likely to be in student debt and more likely to be in more student debt relative to white counterparts. I think, you know, that's a concern. And I think student debt is a problem regardless of what race the borrower is, but I think it's something that has to be addressed. And I think, yeah, programs like the Peace Corps are great, and I think our goal should be to make sure that folks have an opportunity to get an education and then to get a job, because ultimately that's helpful for the whole economy.
Well, thank you so much for your comments and for Sharing with us this morning, Andrew, and let me remind our listeners that Andrew Hanauer of Jubilee USA will speak this evening, Monday, June 13th, in Portland, Oregon, from 5:30 to 8 p.m. at the Holiday Park Plaza, which is located at 1300 Northeast 16th Avenue. His presentation is sponsored by Jubilee Oregon and the USA. Go to their website, jubileeusa.org. Thank you, Andrew, for your very good work, and we are happy that you'll be joining us this evening.
Thank you so much for having me, and I really appreciate it.
You have been listening to More Talk Radio on this Monday. Coming up right after our show is the OMO Variety Hour. Take care of yourself, take care of those you love, and continue to build a better, more just world for all. For Celeste Carey, this is Cecil Prescott. Have a pleasant day.
Thursday, June 16th at 10 p.m. for another special live remote broadcast from What the Festival at the Wolf Run Ranch. Once again, we'll be showcasing the musical and visual artists at this year's festival. With interviews, music, and interactions with the producers, exploring what makes this such a uniquely immersive and entertaining festival. Again, be sure to tune in on Thursday, June 6th festival broadcast. More information can be found on the KBOO website under Community Events.
Check it out, baby. If the funk gets too hot for your rump, turn the other cheek, bump. Yeah.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Real Cool Film Series at the Clinton Street Theater. The film this month, The Case of the Three-Sided Dream, showing Wednesday, June 15th at 7 p.m. The case of the three-sided instrumentalist Rashawn Roland Kirk, who went from a blind infant to a child prodigy to adult visionary to a political activist and finally to a paralyzed showman. Kirk was a seemingly superhuman musical force who played literally until the day he died. Again, that's The Case of the Three-Sided Dream, Wednesday, June 15th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You are listening. Time is coming up on 9 o'clock. The KBOO Evening News produces a nightly one-hour newscast every weekday night. We need writers, editors, reporters, and more to make this grassroots community resource happen. Are you interested? Would you like to try something exciting? Training and writing for radio, interviewing, field recording, and audio editing is all free of charge. But you have to go through the KBOO volunteer orientation first. Email Lisa Loving at newsdirector at 503-231-8032, extension 203. Up next is the Old Mole Variety Hour. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Oregon Zoo Summer Concerts presenting a Buena Vista Social Club, Omara Porontandu and Eliadas Ochoa, Sunday, August 28th at the Oregon Zoo. Doors at 5 and show starts at 7. And tickets and information from Buena Vista Social Club are available at zooconcerts.com.
I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down, and I wish I was a mole in the ground.
You are tuned to KBOO in Portland, where the time now is 9:01, and that's time for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm your host, Clayton Morgridge. Our engineer is Joe Clement.